Once more into the breach, dear friends, else close the wall up with our English dead. Good morning again, ladies and gentlemen. This is Jake McClure at the Personal Wealth Coach. Today, my father has driven off into the north to capture pictures of the sky. He's up, heading up to the most distant corner of the Oklahoma panhandle, where the night skies are extremely dark, so he can take pictures of nebula and galaxies to his heart's delight. Those of you that have seen the pictures, you know what I'm talking about. Those of, of you that haven't should check them out. They're pretty cool. Anyway, that leaves me alone this week to do the radio program. So I'm going to start out with a couple of our normal disclosures. Number one, the Personal Wealth Coach is an SEC registered investment advisory firm. It's also the name of this radio program. The firm is registered with the SEC and gives out fiduciary advice. The radio program is educational. So hopefully what I say today will educate. I can hope. You can hope. If you find yourself disagreeing with me, please call in. Please be polite in your disagreements, but call in. Let me know what your viewpoints are. If I'm saying something incorrectly, I want to be the first to know it. Usually I'm not. I think that's a bit of behavioral psychology there. Usually we're not the first to know when we're wrong. Someone else is. All right, so what's happened this week? The S&P 500, which is our preferred index for measurement, not because we like it a whole lot, but because it's the one that's most widely followed by investors, was down this week almost 1%, so 0.97%. It closed at 2885.57. What is that about? What happened? It's been trying hard to move ahead of what it was at the beginning of the year. The beginning of the year, things were rolling along, rocking along, doing great as far as the market's concerned. So just as a side note, let me throw this in here. A lot of people get confused on this point, so I want to say it out publicly, openly. The market and the economy are not the same thing. The economy has been rocking really hard all year, while the S&P 500 has been relatively flat with some low points in the middle. So last month, we, you know, throw out the air quotes, hard to see these on the radio, we broke a new record in September, barely. We got back up to where we were in January, and then since we've come down a bit. So why? Why is it that the S&P 500 has been struggling so hard to break new ground in 2018, the year where we're having record earnings for the first two quarters in the companies that are traded on the stock market? And the answer is pretty simple. It's one that it's not that difficult to comprehend: the trade war. Anytime you throw uncertainty into a marketplace, don't expect huge amounts of optimism. Any kind of uncertainty. It can be uncertainty about taxes. It can be uncertainty about presidents. It can be uncertainty about who's going to be the next president. It can be uncertainty about trade. In this case, it is trade. We don't know when the tariffs are going to go away or if they're going to go away. Nobody's told us. They're just there. They weren't announced very clearly. It was something that was promised. It's not like it should have been a huge surprise. But we don't know when it's going to end or if it's going to end, which puts a big damper on the forward movement of the market. Because the market, while it's a decent measurement for valuations today, a big part of what it's doing is looking ahead at what it expects valuations to be in the next few years. It's not doing a very good job of that right now because it's uncertain, which is why the market hates uncertainty. If you don't tell investors the things that we're used to hearing, don't expect us to provide a bunch of money to push the market forward. And that's just, that's true in any market. It's true in green beans or in oil or real estate. If you throw out a bunch of uncertainty, and there's a some time frames to look back, if you think back to 1991, I know that was a long time ago for some of you. In 1991, we had some the first year of some real estate tax code changes that caused a pretty major disaster as far as the mortgages in the United States are concerned. Across the board, we had the savings and loans crisis. We had a minor one in the 80s and a major one in the early 90s because the tax law changed. When taxes change, it takes a while for people to figure that out. Okay, in this case, we had a tax drop, and most recently, we had a tax drop. So the market looks at the earnings that are coming in and says, all right, these are one-time things. When I say the market, I'm talking about a group of people and their consensus, because that's really what the market is. It's voting with dollars, and some people get more votes because they have more dollars, but we all have the ability to have a vote there. Anyway, the market's been relatively flat all year. There has been, in the middle of that, a lot of markets that are considerably down. Those are not markets that are in indexes that are tracked regularly in the United States, but the emerging markets have been hit really hard by the trade war. China's down, flirting with 30% down in their stock market at this point. The U.S. dollar is extremely strong right now, which is having a strange effect on trade. So the dollar's really strong, which means we can buy a lot with our dollar. If you're wanting to buy something that's traded in another currency, we can buy a lot more than usual, which means that our trade deficit, again, this last month, widened. It got worse in the terms of, that are most popular. I don't believe that the trade deficit is a negative thing, and I've said that for years. Jeff has said that for years. The idea here that a trade deficit by itself is bad is just simply not true. We're creating enough here that it's still profitable for us to buy elsewhere. And that's and basically anytime you have a wealthy group that can buy more from outside vendors than it's selling to outside vendors, it just means that there's enough money being created somewhere else that the wealth is keeping up with it. Otherwise, our trade deficit's been around for many decades. We would be completely broke if it were a real representation of an imbalance. And that's something fundamentally true across the board. So the trade deficit is not a great metric to start a trade war. And then in the middle of the trade war, what we're seeing is that the trade deficit is getting worse, not better. And the most economically hurt by the trade war are seeing their deficits turn into surpluses for the trade side. So Canada just eked out a surplus in its trade deficit, while ours is getting larger. And that's kind of an interesting factor. It's kind of reverse psychology, but that's what most of the market is. And I will talk about that some more in a moment. I've got a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, enjoy the show. Stocks got hammered the last couple of days, and everybody's blaming bonds for that. Can you sort that out for us?
Sure.
I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Absolutely. Everybody's blaming bonds for the stock market drop, which is sort of ironic. Maybe sardonic is a better word for it. The interest rates across the board for U.S. Treasuries, and I've got some notes on this right here. Let's see. The 10-year U.S. Treasury note closed on Friday up to 3.23%. It was not that long ago that it was below 3%, as in not long ago being a week ago. And I'm going to pull up another document here Just, let's see here. Let's go back to September and look and see the beginning of September. Just a moment, waiting for the internet connection to fill this in. The beginning of September, we were in the 2.8 to 2.9% range for the 10-year Treasury. The beginning of January, we were at 2.4. So come all the way forward to today, where we're flirting with 2.9 throughout September, we came up to 3.23 for the end of the market, the close of the market on Friday. Anytime interest rates go up, it makes new bonds more attractive than old bonds. So if you're about to buy a bond, which is in essence make a loan to someone, so say you've got $1,000 and the interest rates just came up, you can buy a brand new bond for 3.23%, or you can buy from someone else a bond that's trading at a year ago's value, say 2.46, or January's value, 2.46. Which would you prefer? Would you rather get 2.46% or 3.23%? Well, anybody that's shopped around for banks knows that you're going for the higher interest rate. So you go for the higher interest rate, which causes the lower interest rate bonds to be less valuable. You have to discount the value of those bonds so that the relative interest, because it's got a fixed face value, you got to lower that face value internally for the open market to bring the interest rate up around 3.23%. Otherwise, you're not competitive. You will never sell that bond. You can wait till it matures, but if you only bought it in January, then it's going to be little under 10 years before you get your money back. So that's the kind of the seesaw effect of interest rates going up causing bond prices to go down. What's fascinating about this is we've been talking about this as a danger, as have a lot of economists, that interest rates are on a rising cycle. That means that bond prices are going to drop. When it happens, it tends to happen in bursts. So when we're looking at the current interest rate and to think that it's come up a quarter of a percent in about, well, I guess just over 2 weeks, it's come up a quarter of a percent. When you're talking about a quarter of a percent, that is a major percentage of 3%. So coming forward, interest rates and, in a lot of cases, stock prices move a lot like earthquakes, in that friction builds up and builds up and builds up. There's a lot of pressure, and then finally movement, and it's a relatively large movement because it's jerked forward, and then it stops for a while, and then it builds up and it builds up and it builds up. And it moves again. The same happens when you release that pressure over time, when there's less pressure pushing to prices, is that it moves quickly down. We don't have a slow progression of pricing. Now, why is it that the stock market should be dropping based on bond drops? And the answer to that is that there's no rational reason. There's no rational reason for investors to sell their stocks because bond prices are dropping. People still do it. It doesn't, and once we've got this firm decoupling between bonds and stocks again, because we get coupled together, those two things get coupled together. And if you look back to the stock market crash in 2008 and 2009, you'll see that the bonds crashed too. Not U.S. Treasury bonds, but a lot of other bonds were crashing at the same time because nobody knew anything about anything. When we're looking at the stock market, a lot more of the drop has to do with the Fed raising interest rates, which is a very different area than the long-term interest rates. The Fed raises short-term interest rates. And when it rose, when the interest rates rose, and on the short term, it sends a signal to the market that, hey, things may be a little overheated. Things may be going a little too well. During the break, the Fox News break, the anchor mentioned that a lot of people are giving credit to the tax cuts for extending our unemployment lowness as far into this mature business cycle as it's come. That's true. Interest rates coming up right now should have your unemployment rate coming up a little bit too. But it isn't, because we've got a tax cut. Now, what that could do is it could make the pressure build up more and more and more and cause us to have a lot of unemployment suddenly. I don't think that's going to be the case. I think what's going to happen is that this glut of money that we've gotten from the tax cut, people are going to see that money come down slowly, and then they'll stop hiring as quickly. So this is just a normal part of this business cycle. So this concept of interest rates causing the market to drop, it's true in that the sentiment around there is not 100% positive. We've got some negative sentiment coming in. Now, this is one of those counterintuitive psychology moments. If you take a step back and you say, when bad news comes out, like interest rates going up, and the stock market doesn't take a hit, that's when I'm going to be raising a lot of red flags. What we've had is some bad news come out across the board, bad news being good news in this case. But the bad news is that this may not be sustainable forever. And it caused the stock market to drop a little bit. That's good. When the stock market goes up on bad news, that's when we really dig into that irrational exuberance. We're not seeing irrational exuberance if we can see the stock market drop about 1% over a week based on interest rates going up. Now, that doesn't say that we've got a runaway bull market going right now. We're flat for the year. And when we look at earnings, price-to-earnings ratios across the board, we're pretty evenly, fairly priced based on the history of price-to-earnings ratios. The fact that the interest rates went up across the board means that dreaded yield curve inversion that we've been talking about for so long has been postponed, because the interest rates have come up faster on the long-term side of things than on the short-term, which is absolutely fantastic. So looking at the overall health of the market, I wouldn't be too concerned right now. If you're in emerging markets, and this is kind of where I was going before the caller, emerging markets have taken it on the chin, because the fact that the dollar is so valuable right now, a lot of the emerging markets have to buy things from us in order to create a more complete thing to sell back to us. And that's caused them to have some problems. It's also caused the tariffs have also caused the prices for what they're selling to go up. So in anticipation of us having a lower demand, their stock markets dropped. But we've had a higher demand. Our trade deficit is widening, which means we're buying more things with our money. We're importing more, which should have a long-term opposite effect from this downturn on the emerging markets. Long-term, they should be doing really well. A lot of money is coming to them right now, more money than they expected. Which comes back to trade. Trade wars, tariffs, are taxes on the consumer of the country that passes the tariff. That's a bunch of complicated stuff all thrown in there. Just think of a tariff as a tax on consumers. You, not a tax on manufacturers, whether that's China or the emerging markets. It's not a tax on them. They have to pay it, but they just raise the price to us. Mr. Kudlow, one of the top economic advisors to the president, said that with this new set of tariffs against China, $200 billion in tariffs at 10%, and on January 1st, that's supposed to go up to 25%, He said that consumers will hardly notice. There will be rising prices, but it will be spread out across so many things that consumers will barely notice it. And I wanted to give applause at that, because that was one of the best definitions for inflation I've ever heard. Prices rising across the board, small enough and spread out enough that consumers barely notice it until a year later and they look back and they say, look at all the price rise. What the top economic advisor to the president just said is that they are, in effect, waving off that they are creating inflation with this because it's not a big deal in their mind. It makes the job of the Fed harder, but what it says is that deep down, the top economic advisor knows that, that trade tariffs cause inflation. It's, obviously, that's for any economist, they should say, well, duh, of course it does. That's not how it's being sold.
3 minute stations.
Oh, we got three minutes
to your next Fox
News. I've got to play some commercials. So what I'm going to do is I'll come back to this in a minute. I'm going to talk about kind of the reverse psychology that happens in the markets so often. And I'm going to use some non-marketplace concepts to kind of show the truth in that. I'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. This is Jake McClure. If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number in here is 254-773-1400, and I'll be back. And I'm back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. This is Jake McClure. The phone number to call in here is 773-1400. That's 254-773-1400. All right. I just promised that I was going to give you an example of the common reverseness of marketplaces in a non-marketplace idea. It's got marketplaces involved. During Bill Clinton's presidency, gun sales were extremely high. A lot of people were concerned that there would be new laws passed to outlaw guns. So a lot of people were buying guns. Those that were of the opposite mentality to Bill Clinton when it came to guns went out and said, hey, I may not have this opportunity again. I'm going to buy guns. During George H.W. Bush, gun sales were down. And so then came Clinton, gun sales were up. Then George W. Bush, gun sales were down. So when you look at the political climate, if let's put yourself in the shoe of someone that believes that everybody should own as many guns as possible. And maybe you anyway. So you're buying guns because you're afraid that the gun buying right will go away. During George W. Bush, we had fewer people buying guns. Gun sales were still there, but gun companies were struggling. Barack Obama was elected. We had one of the most fascinating micro marketplace events that I have watched. Ammunition disappeared from the shelves of Walmart and Academy and gun shops across the country. And people thought, well, this must be true then. It must be that the President Obama, must be banning all ammunition sales. When the reality was that the people thought that Obama might abolish ammunition sales, so they bought a lot of ammunition, which was much, they were buying much faster than the ammunition manufacturers could make it. So almost every type of ammunition became hard to find, which became part of the rumor of Obama must be doing this, which made people buy even more. So instead of going in and buying a box of 22 rounds, people went in, and when they could, they just bought every 22-round box that they could grab while they were there. Stores started putting limits on how much you could buy, because otherwise people would show up just to empty shelves. And the limits on the ammunition, again, reinforced the rumor that somehow the political party in power was removing the right to buy ammunition. Now, given a chance,
the president at the time, Barack Obama, might have limited ammunition sales. He didn't have the political capital or clout to do that. It's, I mean, the Second Amendment's a pretty well-defined, both legally and in writing. So he can't just say no. But earnings for gun companies were through the roof during a time of recession, during a time when things weren't that great. Things were improving, but they were not that great. Come forward to today, there shouldn't be a big surprise that Remington, one of the largest gun companies on the planet, has declared bankruptcy. Because the people that that elected someone to protect their gun rights don't feel pressured to go out and buy guns while they still can. That's not there anymore. There's no crisis, so they don't have to go and react to it. That's the way marketplaces work. When you get comfortable that your views are being protected, you don't defend them as much. Whether that's ammunition sales or you could go down a list of many, many things. When we're talking about the stock market, when everyone agrees that the stock market is going to do well for the foreseeable future, that's when you should be worried, because they're comfortable with where the stock market is, just like people that buy guns were comfortable with the election of Donald Trump. Now, I have not said anything positive or negative on this. This is just human behavior. Human behavior is that when we are comfortable and there's no crisis to make us do something, we won't do the thing most often. There are some people that plan ahead anyway, and they say, hey, we're not always going to have a Republican office in office, or we're not always going to have a Democrat in office. And they act the same way with a Republican or Democrat in office. But the majority of us human beings in the United States build our worldview very quickly around a microcosm of the moment. So one of the studies that I had, and I'm sure everybody listening has had this, studying World War II in school or on the History Channel, doesn't matter where you did it. Did you ever notice that the propaganda machines kicked in? We went from, this is the first time that I remember this dichotomy in my mind, this separately held viewpoint comfortably with another one in my mind. The Germans had an agreement with Russia, and Russia was their big buddy. And Russia had an agreement with the Germans, and the propaganda was all about how good Russia was in Germany, and in Russia, how good, and Russia being the Soviet Union at the time, how good Germany was. They're our good friends, we love them, and so on. Until Germany invaded. And then immediately, that propaganda went out the window, and it became something else. So how did the Germans, how were they politically motivated to invade the Soviet Union when the propaganda machine was so big in that direction? What we're seeing right now in a shift of our foreign policy, of the United States' foreign policy, it's not on the realm of propaganda in the United States, although in some ways it is. The left has an arm and the right has an arm. And then there's the president, and they have the bully pulpit. The president always has the biggest voice. They have the ability to go out and give their viewpoint. With Twitter, it's a direct viewpoint, but they could be saying it on the news or anywhere else. So I'm kind of... Let's make this vanilla and not think of Democrat or Republican, but just president. So the president has the ability to say what they believe directly. Then we have the media, which you may agree with or disagree with, but there's a lot of different sources for media. So you can take the group and say, what are they saying? And if the president and the media are at each other's throat, that makes me happy. It doesn't matter if it's a Democrat or a Republican in office. During Bill Clinton's impeachment, the media was not kind to him. I mean, how many front page pictures of a dress with a stain on it do you want to see? I mean, that's not a friendly liberal newspaper chumming up to the president there. And today, the media is doing its job as well. And this is quite humorous in that I haven't changed the subject from the opposites having an effect. The New York Times was absolutely failing during the Obama administration. Its readership was down, and it is, you know, by and large, it's a liberal newspaper. They do report news that is outside of the liberal bent, but their opinion section is a major portion of their newspaper, and it's got an extreme liberal bent. So, Barack Obama's elected and causes the readership of the New York Times to drop. A liberal's in office, again, just like the gun sales. When a Republican's in office, gun sales go down, which is the opposite of what most people would expect on the surface. When a liberal's in office, liberal newspapers do poorly. Conservative talk shows do great. When a conservative is in office, liberal papers and liberal news sources do very well, while the ratings for the conservative side start down. We can see that happening right now in that Rachel Maddow had the top rated hour of television across any news source for a week. This is from MSNBC, which during as far back as I can remember had the lowest ratings anywhere. So this normal reaction of what's going on here, it means that our system's working. It means that when the loudest voice, the bully pulpit, whether that's Barack Obama, George W. Bush, or Donald Trump, it doesn't matter. When they have a loud voice, the people that disagree with them want to hear another source. And they go to the place that sounds most like what they want to hear. It doesn't mean that they're getting good news. It doesn't mean that they're getting bad news. It just means that they're going to the source that they want to hear. They want to hear what's important to them being said. The same is true in the market. So we just talked about two kind of microcosms of almost niche markets, the media market and the gun sale market. Those markets are completely affected by politics. They are absolutely intertwined with them. And it used to be for a long time that tobacco sales were also intertwined with politics. But at this point, we've gotten so ratcheted down on the tobacco companies, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat, it's just been well enough proved that if you're throwing out secondhand smoke, you're hurting all the kids in the area. You shouldn't do it in a restaurant. And that's kind of like guns. You shouldn't be shooting your guns willy-nilly into crowds. That's a little bit more extreme, but that's the idea. We've got regulations. We've got laws that say you can't do that. Once we know that there's a danger and it's a well-accepted fact that it really is a danger, then it doesn't matter if you're a Republican or a Democrat. You don't want your newborn baby to be locked in a car with a chain smoker. You just don't want that to happen. You don't want a 12-year-old untrained person with a handgun in the car with your newborn baby either. So that's not saying that you shouldn't have the right to smoke if you want to smoke. It's saying that you shouldn't be smoking next to newborns. And it doesn't say that you shouldn't have the right to have a firearm. It just says that you need to treat it like a right that comes of age or having an adult present. So all of that, it's an interesting dichotomy, because when we're looking at the market, the top of the market is often flagged with exuberance. When everybody says it's good, it's by definition not. It's the same opposite effect. It is exactly the same. Once you're comfortable that saying the market's always going to go up or the economy's always going to go up, that's when you should be very carefully socking away as much as you can for the downturn that will shortly be coming. Even if you still believe that the stock market is going to be going up greatly into the future, it's still a good idea to sock some of it away now, because it's up now. The danger is anytime people are making their decisions saying the market's going to be up for the next 2 years for sure, so I'm just going to dump a bunch of money into it. The danger there is if you dump all of your assets in there, including your short-term savings, when the market drops, and notice I didn't say if, because the market isn't smooth. That's how we've gotten these historically much higher returns in the market than other asset classes is because it's not smooth. And if you just leave it alone, turn your back on it, close your eyes, and go about your business, you're probably going to be in good shape as long as you're really well diversified. If you're trying to make your decisions on how much to invest today based on what you think the market's going to do in the next few years, you're doing it wrong. Doesn't mean you can't make money doing it. It means that you're setting yourself up to make some bad decisions that if you were just ignoring it, wouldn't be a bad decision. That's one of those weird things. It's kind of backwards to think, ignore this rather than think about it. Because in many, many cases, we want you to think about things. And we want you to think about this, the market. We want you to be in here for a much longer time period than the next 2 or 3 years. If you're in the market now, hopefully everybody that's listening is. If you're in the market now, I am not, and nor will you ever hear us say, get out of the market. What we are going to say a lot more and a lot more loudly over the next however long until the market drops is be prepared for a market drop. Don't get out. You know, that I was on an airplane with an engineer, and I had said something similar to this, and he started writing down. He said, well, if you get out now, then you could avoid that drop. Don't you think that's a good idea just to get out now? And my answer to him is, and do what? Where would you take the money? Would you put it in a cash position? Are you going to buy real estate with it? Because there's a different market cycle there. We might be getting close to overpriced in the real estate market as well. So where do you put it? And he said, well, cash. Well, then the next question is, when do you buy back in? When's the bottom of the market after the downturn? And what happens if we have another 4 years of up market between now and the downturn? You've lost out on a lot of that growth in your assets by trying to get out too soon. What you should do is build a plan around always allocating some money for your savings. Always. That's the first one. Make sure that your short-term cash positions are your first priority. If you have emergencies, when you have emergencies, you don't want to be saying, oh, I've got to repair the roof on my house right as the stock market drops and you've got all your money in there. Because then you're pulling out your credit cards. That's not good. So you want to have a good cash position always. Good market, bad market, shouldn't matter. And you want to allocate money if you have the ability when the market's down. You want to allocate more money to investing. When the market is fairly priced, you should look at it and say it's fairly priced, which means that I'm buying it fairly priced. Which, you know, long term, that means that you have a pretty good historical chance of having some appreciation in there. If you look around and the market is really, really overpriced, there's always parts of the market that aren't overpriced. So there's always parts of the market that are overpriced. And this is something our email newsletter and paper newsletter, for those of you that are still getting it that way, this week, we talked about how growth stocks are really taking off right now. We've got the S&P 500, which is relatively flat, but we've got growth stocks that are just launching. And what that means to us is that this really is the mature portion of a bull market. Because if you think back to the year 2000, or you go back to the year 2005, 2006, 2007, what you'll see is that the growth stocks take off and leave the value stocks behind. That is a good red flag to say, hey, slow down. You should start stepping back from the growth positions and becoming more value oriented, because as many times as I see this happen, it shouldn't be a surprise to us that this is part of the normal cycle. But just like in politics, just like with gun sales and media sales, we're stuck in a microcosm of this moment and making our decisions in this moment. Spread your viewpoint out. Look back through history and say, has this happened before? What should I do to prepare for the next things that tend to happen in history after points like this? And that's an important factor. Bond prices going down rationally shouldn't cause the stock market to drop. The stock market dropped because bond prices dropped. What that tells me is just like when the stock market dropped and gold dropped at the same time, is and the way that Madoff was detected in his scam, the stock market dropped, and Madoff's fund didn't drop, by the way, during that. People started making liquidations from his fund to pay for their other expenses that they had been going to the market for. And then he ran out of money because it wasn't really there. So what, that same thing happens with gold. When the stock market drops and gold drops at the same time, which happens regularly, it's because people are selling gold to meet their needs that they were selling the market for. And in the case where we're no longer the largest, the United States is no longer the largest purchaser of gold, India and China take that. China first and then India take the we buy gold attitude. And when their stock market drops, you should expect the price of gold to drop too. Even if our stock market is up and down, we're decoupled from that now. We're not the major purchasers. So there's a lot of cycles that have changed a little bit, but not much. You just have to look, where's the source of the money? As long as you can follow the source of the money, the cycle hasn't changed at all, and it's not too hard to do that. I've got to play some more commercials, and I'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you would like to join the conversation, the phone number to call in here is 254-773-1400, and I'll be back on the other side. And I'm back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. We've got about 6 minutes left this hour, and we'll be back next hour for more of the Personal Wealth Coach. I have another fascinating historical comparison to make. Fascinating to me, anyway. You might all be needing a drool pillow or something for the boredom, but I am fascinated by this. Amazon last month, and this happened, we didn't have a whole lot of time to talk about it, but Amazon last month announced that it's considering opening up to 3,000 cashierless stores by 2021. That they're basically taking the convenience store model that they had and they've used in New York and in San Francisco, and they're saying we'll move forward with that across the country. Oh, maybe. They're considering it. Why is this historically fascinating? Cashierless stores have not existed before. I mean, people have had, you know, trust stores where you go in, you know, kind of like a library, you check things out and you bring it back or whatever. But when it comes to cashierless, this is new. So how is there a fascinating historical perspective here? Well, if you go back to how Sears was founded, Sears, I realize that Sears is not a place that the younger generation has gone to quite that much, but Sears began as a virtual store. It used a new form of communication, a new platform for communication to allow people to order from their bedrooms, from their living rooms, the furniture and the dry goods and the appliances, tools that they would need for their day-to-day existence. And they were competing with the general store quite well. You had to wait for the delivery to come in, but the price difference was pretty nice. So Sears, for many decades being about three, didn't have a store. We think about Sears today, and we think of these large department-type stores that that Sears became. They didn't have brick and mortar. They didn't have the buildings or the warehouses. They had a shipping facility. And the new platform that people were purchasing through was the telegraph. Instantaneous communication from one side of the country to the other. Wasn't quite instantaneous, but you know what I mean. So Amazon is following in the footsteps of Sears. This is how companies mature. The fact is that Amazon's market share is great. They want to come in and they see convenience stores as a good place to disrupt. Because convenience stores, if you've ever been in a convenience store, all of us have, the prices in there are not as good as a grocery store because you're paying for the convenience. You're also paying for the fact that they have a lot fewer goods in there, and they've got two or three full-time employees to watch those candy bar aisles and the canned good little half section, and the oil and the water and the Gatorade and all of that stuff is stuck onto the sides. It's not a lot of goods to sell for two full-time employees. And if you think about that, they're open 24 hours a day sometimes. So how are they making a living? Well, they have to raise the prices of their goods, and we know that. We've kind of taken that for granted. And people say, well, it's not that different from the grocery store. Well, if you're buying a single water bottle at a grocery store, you're going to save maybe 10 cents on the water bottle. If you're buying the single water bottle at a convenience store, it's maybe a little bit more expensive, not a lot. But if you're buying water bottles, if you're buying a package of water bottles at a grocery store, you're going to save many dollars over the convenience store. The convenience stores have always been more expensive. And Amazon's looking at that and saying, if we don't have to have full-time employees in there, if we've got a cashierless system that you've got a membership, you've got to hit a certain code on your phone for the door to open, and then it's tracking what you buy based on the location of your phone in the store and what you're putting in your cart. And as you leave the store, you've paid for it on your app. You don't have to pay the people. They've just raised the minimum wage. This happened just this week for their employees in the warehouses to $15 an hour. And they're contemplating going in, replacing a concept of employment completely across the country. So it's fascinating to look at. There's a lot of new things in that, but there's also they're wrapping themselves up in the same kind of brick and mortar that Sears eventually did, and it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. We're about out of time for this hour. This is the Personal Wealth Coach, and we do offer personalized fiduciary investment advice to our clients. If you would like to call and talk to us off the air, the phone number to reach is 254-947-1111. There's voicemail during the weekend and real live people during the week. You can reach that number toll free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, and you can email me at jake@tpwc.com or jeff@tpwc.com. And until next hour, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.